Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I can't say that I became a drummer because I made that bread, but they're very linked in my mind. And I think part of it is that physicality.
Frida Love Smith never went to music school, and she has no formal culinary training. She says her enthusiasm and passion for both are what have driven her to be successful. We talk about the intersection of those two parts of her life on today's show. Finding the sweet spot for regulating antibiotic use in livestock. Also, we meet a couple of alpaca farmers who are picking up the pieces after the wool bubble burst. And finger foods with Chef Daniel Orr. Raw cauliflower popcorn for something light and simple. Then cheesy, savory bonbons to completely ruin your dinner. Mark Chilla with four news stories to know from the week.
A senior scientist at the U.S. Agriculture Department filed a whistleblower complaint this week that adds fuel to the controversy swirling around a popular pesticide. Harvest Public Media's Peggy Lowe reports.
Jonathan Lundgren is a USDA entomologist in South Dakota. He says his research on a class of pesticides called neonicotinoids has been suppressed by the federal agency. His findings suggest the pesticides may harm honeybees and monarch butterflies. Reporter Carrie Gillum.
There have been several scientific reports that supposedly have been watered down. Dr. Jonathan Lundgren is the first USDA scientist to really come forward publicly and speak about his experience.
USDA regulates the big agribusinesses whose profits could be affected by the studies. USDA has denied these claims and said it has a strong scientific integrity policy. Peggy Lowe, Harvest Public Media.
The USDA declined to comment about Lundgren's case or his specific complaints, but in a statement, the agency said it takes the integrity of its scientists' work seriously. The statement said, quote, "We recognize how critical that is to maintaining widespread confidence in our research among the scientific community, policymakers, and the general public," unquote. Also this week, the World Health Organization released a report that linked diets heavy on red and processed meat to certain types of cancer. An international scientific panel found that regularly eating processed meat like sausage and bacon increases the risk of colorectal cancer. But a Denver-based group researching ranchers and meatpacking companies says the data is murky. Shailene McNeil is a registered dietitian with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
What we see is weakening evidence over time, study associations that are only significant about half of the time, and an evidence base that just does not support a causal association between red and processed meat and any type of cancer.
The WHO finding puts processed meat into the same category of cancer risk as smoking, though that does not mean the two activities are equally as dangerous. The study also found that charring, smoking, and grilling meat may contribute to the prevalence of cancer-causing chemicals. The average American eats 89 pounds of chicken a year. According to a report out this week, that demand takes an enormous toll on the workers. The report by Oxfam America says workers are facing factory line speeds that have doubled. Many cut up 34 chickens a minute. Oliver Gottfried of Oxfam America says the four big poultry companies give a single half-hour lunch break, but forbid workers from leaving the line during an eight-hour shift.
That means that workers aren't allowed to go to the bathroom, even when they ask for it. And so many workers have reported either dramatically reducing their intake of liquids or being forced to wear diapers on the line.
A spokesman for the National Chicken Council says there's been a decrease in injuries in the last 20 years, and it's working on new ways to protect its workforce. And let's end today with a feel-good story. New York City is selecting 100 schools to take part in a pilot project to recycle or compost all of the waste they produce. The program is part of Mayor Bill de Blasio's goal to eliminate the use of landfills by 2030. The city has been expanding a school composting program over the last 3 years, with 720 schools now participating. A survey of 9 Manhattan schools showed that nearly half of the school's food waste was saved from landfills as a result of that experiment. Thanks to Harvest Public Media reporters and Chad Bouchard for these stories. You can read them at eartheats.org.
We also look forward to hearing from you on Twitter at EarthEats. Food news for the week. Thanks, Mark.
Anytime.
The antibiotics we depend on to defeat infections are in crisis, and the meat industry is partially responsible. New rules meant to target that part of the problem are coming, but as farmers adjust to the changes, some critics fear they don't go far enough. As part of Harvest Public Media's series Choice Cuts, Meat in America, Amy Mayer has the story.
There's a growing problem in human medicine.
We are nearly on the brink of being back in the pre-antibiotic era.
That's Loreen Herwalt, a professor of infectious disease and internal medicine at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine.
And that's pretty scary in terms of, you know, not having anything to treat people with who have serious infections.
She's talking about antibiotic-resistant infections. We can cure many bacterial diseases with antibiotics, but the more we use them, the less effective the medicines become. That's because when we hit them with antibiotics, some bacteria survive. Their resistance spreads, and then thousands of patients die each year from infections that some of our best medicines can't cure. And farmers use a lot of antibiotics raising food animals. Exact numbers are elusive, but it's safe to say most antibiotics sold in the United States are used in livestock, not people or pets.
Modern livestock production systems have co-evolved with antimicrobials.
Hans Kutzia is a professor at the Iowa State University College of Veterinary Medicine. He says long ago, farmers discovered antibiotics have many uses.
So we have systems where we've used antimicrobials in some cases to control disease in populations of animals, and in some cases to promote growth and performance in those populations of animals.
Under new federal rules, drug makers are barred from marketing certain antibiotics for growth promotion. Also, drugs important for human medicine will require a veterinarian's approval for use in livestock. Until now, farmers have bought many over the counter. But some critics think it will be too easy to evade the new restrictions. Kathy Eckhaus is a co-owner of La Quercha, a maker of specialty meats in Iowa.
People will still be able to say they can use antibiotics to prevent disease rather than to treat an actual existing condition. And that's a pretty big barn door to drive something through.
To be sure, there are also situations when people get antibiotics prophylactically. Say when one college student gets bacterial meningitis and her roommates are given antibiotics to prevent the infection. But Eckhaus is worried low or preventative doses will be used when they're not needed.
I feel that it's a bit of a slippery slope situation. Slippery slope, big barn door.
The new rules are spurring livestock producers to explore alternatives to antibiotics.
And the pigs, yes. No, you're okay.
Jean Gourley, a researcher who comes from a hog farming family, has pens of four-week-old piglets in this barn.
So this is all set up for vaccine. Right now, we actually vaccine-treated these little pigs when they came in.
Vaccines are one tool that can help replace antibiotics. Gourley says a decade ago, a new vaccine helped his family greatly reduce antibiotic use in their swine.
Since 2005, we haven't had any growth promotants or antibiotics in finishing feeds. So the last 4 months of life, the animals won't see antibiotics unless there's a health challenge or something that you need to use it for a welfare standpoint.
The increased attention to antibiotic resistance could have another impact. Kutzia at the vet school says so-called antimicrobial stewardship, using the medications cautiously and in the right amounts, may help bring human and veterinary researchers together.
We're starting to recognize that some of the challenges we face are quite similar, and I think some of our production systems that we work with every day on the veterinary side actually would serve as very good model systems for understanding the emergence and dissemination of resistant bacteria within the population of animals.
As in human medicine, Kutzia says growing understanding of the bacteria that belong in an animal is fueling research that could lead to antibiotic alternatives. So even as farmers have contributed to the problem, their animals may be well poised to help people find solutions. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Later on today, the market for alpaca wool never reached the heights that some investors had hoped for. So now what? Harvest will tell the story of a couple alpaca farmers in Colorado. Bloomington, Indiana native Frida Love Smith is a legend in the local punk scene. She was the drummer for the Blake Babies, Antenna, and the Mysteries of Life in the 80s and 90s. The Paste columnist chronicles her life in music and her love of food in her new memoir, Red Velvet Underground. Along with rock and roll memories, we follow her cooking lessons with her son, Jonah. One of their first lessons is how to bake bread, which is fitting because one of the first times food and music collided for her was as a teenager working in a Bloomington bakery. She was making pain brûlé, French bread that required pounding the dough. But I had to start with her legacy at a different local eatery, Soma. Okay, so first of all, I did not realize that you were the creator of the Cosmic Muffin. So a celebrity is in my midst.
Ah, thank you.
Can you talk about how you came up with this idea for this recipe?
It was a long time ago, but I do remember it well because it was such a fun process. And it was the first time that I created, really kind of the last time that I created a commercial product. But it was really in collaboration with the owners of the bakery as they're opening Soma Bakery and Coffee Shop, and they wanted to offer vegan treats. And I think the idea for the Cosmic Muffin was that it would be this mega brand muffin, that it would be a complete meal in itself, and that we would just put as much stuff as possible in it, and ideally it would still be tasty and easy enough to make every day.
Are you going to go get one?
I think I will go get one. I usually do.
Do you say to the barista, hey?
I did that once, and I didn't get much of a response. One time I went in and I took pictures of it in the case, and they seemed nervous.
I love the story of you baking bread at the Daily Bread with a baseball bat. And it just seemed to me like this is exactly what a drummer-to-be should be doing.
Oh, absolutely. It was very physical. It was very rhythmic. And not only that, there was a soundtrack. I was, you know, having this experience and baking this bread while I was listening to a band that would become really formative and really important to me. I can't separate the Velvet Underground from that experience. It's all so tied together. I can't say that I became a drummer because I made that bread, but they're very linked in my mind. And people do think that, you know, my love of food, my experience with food, and my experience as a drummer seem like these disparate things. But they don't seem like that to me. And I think part of it is that physicality.
I'm waiting for my man.
There's a really brief story that you tell about hearing Meat is Murder by the Smiths for the very first time. That jump-started your vegetarianism.
It did.
You then say that you're embarrassed to admit it, the very next paragraph. Why are you embarrassed to admit that?
I guess I never shared with anybody, even in the moment, that hearing that song inspired me so instantaneously and so completely.
Yeah, the cow mooing in the background, this weird industrial machine sound.
It's a powerful piece of propaganda, mm-hmm. and that's what it's really meant to be. And maybe I didn't want to admit that I was the kind of person that a powerful piece of propaganda could work so effectively on, but it did.
This beautiful creature must die. A death for no reason, and death for no reason is murder.
There's this part in the book where you say the drums overwhelmed you. They got the better of you. What do you mean by that?
Part of it was a size thing, like being a small woman, and my first drum kit wasn't sized to me. I think because a lot of the bands that I was really into were kind of powerful punk bands, I was trying to emulate something that was a little bit beyond me. Physically, it took me some time to come to terms with my own physical limitations and my own technical limitations.
Have you ever felt that way in the kitchen, in your cooking life?
I have. There are parallels because, you know, again, I haven't taken cooking classes. I didn't go to culinary school. It's not something that I've done publicly, so I haven't had maybe as strong of those pangs. But I have had moments. I mean, I write about food a lot now. I love food. I'm really passionate about it. And I do have some professional experience. But again, I sort of jumped in with all my enthusiasm and all, you know, my interest and my passion for it.
Let's think about maybe one of the most simple recipes, a good beginner recipe that you can make in your sleep. And then think about one of the first drum parts that you learned. Simple. You mastered it. Again, you can play it in your sleep. I'm putting you on the spot, I know.
No, that's okay. I mean, I think with Jonah, the lessons that we had around making stir fry were really productive. Like, I feel like a lot of what we were working on with the cooking lessons started to coalesce for him. That was a really good basic, not even recipe, but more sort of technique for him to learn. He learned how to improvise, to sort of make a meal out of whatever you happen to have. And then as far as a drumbeat, I can actually kind of hear the drumbeat in my head, but it's a little bit hard to explain. But just kind of—
Can you speak the drumbeat?
Oh, I've never tried to do this before. But just a simple sort of eighth note funk drumbeat, like—
And the is the bass drum?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what do those two things, stir fry and a simple eighth note funk beat?
Yeah, let's say that.
What do those two things have in common?
I would say their versatility. It's kind of like having a trick in your bag, like something that you can pull out that will almost always work. And once you know it, you've got it under your belt.
Frida Love Smith writes about the intersection of food and music in her memoir Red Velvet Underground. An extended cut of our conversation is at eartheats.org. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Holiday parties are right around the corner, if you can believe it. We'll talk about the big cooking projects in the coming weeks. Turkey, duck, that sort of thing. But today we'll give you some hors d'oeuvres ideas. Our second recipe is rich and powerful. This first one is light and raw. It's cauliflower popcorn. Gardeners, maybe your ears perked up. If you planted some cauliflower seeds back in mid-August, the heads are probably starting to look perfect for the picking right about now. Or you can just snag a head or two next time you go to your farmer's market. That's what our man Daniel Orr did for today's recipe.
We've got the head of the cauliflower, and you've got all this green on the outside. Now, a lot of people just throw this away. But you pay as much for this as you do for the cauliflower. So I like to wash it off, and then this makes a great thing to dip with, okay? And you can eat it. It tastes just like cauliflower. Okay, what we're going to do today is make cauliflower popcorn. All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to cut this up into little pieces, so it actually looks like popcorn, but you really only want to make it enough that you're going to eat that right away. And then what we're going to do is take some nutritional yeast seasoning. So we'll just toss some of that in, and we'll put a little salt and pepper, okay, and just toss it. So you can sit around and pull this in front of the TV set or next to the computer screen and not feel guilty at all.
An alone time snack or a healthy side to bring to a pitch-in. More finger food coming up. Alpacas are known for their calm temperaments and soft fleece, and a few years ago they looked like the next hot thing coming to backyard farmers. So hot investors sank thousands of dollars into top-of-the-line animals. But the bubble burst, leaving thousands of alpaca breeders with near-worthless herds. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon went looking for what's become of the alpaca farmer.
One day about 10 years ago, Terry Holtz and his wife Dina came across a photo of a cuddly creature with a slender neck and long eyelashes.
She happened to see a picture of one on the internet, and she says, "Oh, they're most adorable animals." So we go, what is it? You mean like a llama? No, they're called alpacas. There's a difference.
Holtz says initially he was skeptical. Yeah, they're cute. but are they just fancy pets?
What's the bottom line here? How are they? Are they making money? Is there really a need for those animals? The answer was absolutely.
They decided to buy a few alpacas. The couple's 10-acre ranch is just south of the Colorado-Wyoming border, near the town of Wellington. At the height of the bubble, some were fetching hundreds of thousands of dollars at auction. The couple started breeding them and selling the offspring.
Wow, all I have to do is sell 7 of them, and I'm making more than I am at my regular job, and I only sold 7 alpacas, and it wasn't that hard to do.
The Holtzes weren't the only ones. Alpacas have proliferated across the country. Back in the 1980s, you'd really only find them in zoos. Now there's close to 150,000 in the U.S. Their only marketable product is wool, but the high hopes for a U.S. alpaca garment industry never materialized.
Okay, the sales slowed down. The cost of hay doubled.
The value of their herd plummeted. That's why after a decade in the alpaca breeding business, they're selling out, liquidating the herd. Their Craigslist post calls it a super deal. 30 alpacas for $3,000. That's just $100 a head.
Come on, girls.
When alpacas fail to produce enough fiber to cover the cost of their hay, they sometimes wear out their welcome. And some end up here, Linda Hayes's llama and alpaca rescue outside Carbondale, Colorado.
Most of my time, rather than dealing with the animals themselves, is dealing with the phone calls and the emails, trying to put potential owners with people that want to get rid of them.
After the bubble burst, people began looking for a way out. Alpaca rescues have popped up across the country. Hayes says she gets calls every week.
I've had a few that were crying. I mean, it's sad. One lady just didn't have the money. She was being evicted.
Hayes says the alpacas were often pitched to older folks, people looking to retire to a more bucolic lifestyle.
Wake up to the wonderful world of alpacas.
Even late-night TV commercials touted the animal's ability to pad a retiree's income.
We've been raising alpacas for 9 years now. I retired 2 years ago because of the alpacas, and it's just been a wonderful lifestyle.
And it was absolutely a house of cards.
Rich Sexton is an agricultural economist at the University of California, Davis.
There was never the slightest chance that it could survive and prosper.
Unless alpaca sweaters are the next hot Christmas item, there's little demand for the wool. Plus, Peru already has a huge alpaca fiber industry, where it's produced much cheaper than it is here. Sexton says America has a long history of agricultural bubbles. It was emus in the 80s and chinchillas in the 1950s.
Most likely, there's another one coming down the pike if people don't have their eyes and ears open.
Some small remnants of the bubble still exist. Prize-winning alpacas can still sell for a couple $1,000s, but it's not like it was in the heyday.
These are all the females.
Alpaca rancher Terry Holt says he still wants to work with the wool, even after he sells the herd. He bought equipment to felt alpaca fiber for hats and sweaters.
Looking back like 10 years, if you had known what you know now, would you still have bought them?
Honestly, probably not.
And Holt says his biggest lesson in this whole thing? Take a step back before you decide to follow the herd. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
There are pictures that go with this story. See them at harvestpublicmedia.org.
All right, when anybody comes over to visit me at my cabin and I'm cooking dinner for them, I'm always trying to think of something I can prepare ahead of time that's simple and easy to keep them occupied, get them started with a few cocktails. And so I'm kind of creating a recipe based on bonbons. And it usually has to do with sweets after dinner, little chocolate bonbons and that kind of thing. But I'm making savory bonbons today. We're going to make two different kinds. We're going to make sun-dried tomato and goat cheese bonbons and toasted walnut and Roquefort bonbons.
Back with Daniel Orr in the kitchen.
What I've done with the sun-dried tomatoes, I've poured hot water over them and let them soak. And what that does is it makes them very tender and malleable, and you'll be able to stuff them now, and they won't kind of pop back because we're going to kind of wrap them around almost like a taco around the goat cheese. All right, now I've got my goat cheese. We use Capriol goat cheese. Now you want to use a fresh goat cheese for this. You wouldn't want to go out and buy a real expensive aged goat cheese because that you want to just eat on its own. I'm going to take about a half cup of that. We're going to add some herbs. Now, if you have nice fresh herbs out of your garden, use them. Just whatever you have. We had some scallions and some basil. And just a little squeeze of olive oil. We're going to add about a small clove of garlic, minced up very, very fine. We're going to do a pinch of coarsely ground pepper. Now, I always suggest that you use freshly ground pepper. You can do that in a coffee grinder, or if you've got a really good blender, you can buzz it up in there. So you just want to blend up what you're going to use in about a week and a half. Another thing with spices is I always suggest that you revamp your spice drawer about once a year. You don't want to have antique spices. So I usually say use those up during the holidays and then start fresh every year with some new spices. Okay, we're going to blend that up, and you can use your best tool in the kitchen, your hands. And you want to give it a little taste. Now, sun-dried tomatoes sometimes have been salted a bit, so you want to be careful with the amount of salt that you use in your filling if your tomatoes are salty. It's so good. Okay, we're just going to stuff those and wrap them around. So again, they are kind of like little stuffed taco shells of sun-dried tomatoes. And we're also then going to make our walnut bonbons. You know, the most difficult part of this recipe is to toast your walnuts, because they're really easy to burn. But it's important to do that, because what that does is it kind of reduces the moisture in the walnuts, makes them a little crunchier, intensifies the flavor, so you will get kind of a nuttier nut flavor. And it's basically very similar. We're just going to take two of those walnut halves, a little ball of Roquefort cheese. You could use any blue cheese. The Roquefort tends to be a little creamier. And there we've got our walnut bonbons. And we're just going to do about 10 or 12 of these.
It's a sandwich.
Yeah, it's like a sandwich. Okay, then we'll just add just a touch of olive oil to give them a little shine. Okay, and those are our sun-dried tomato and walnut bonbons filled with goat cheese and Roquefort.
So when he was all done prepping this recipe, I had to ask him where he got the idea for it. He said when he was working in New York City, a customer called and asked for something special to serve as an appetizer at a get-together they were hosting that evening. Well, necessity is the mother of invention after all, so Daniel ran to the fridge, pulled out whatever ingredients looked good, and made up these little savory bonbons right on the spot. To him, he says, that is exactly what being a chef is all about. He was so kind to write out these recipes for us, and they are posted at eartheats.org. Our crew at Earth Eats is Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Kate Griebel, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepherd, Kale Wilk, and the reporters at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. See you next time on the cooler side of fall. I'm Annie Corrigan.